really being able to meet the needs in our rural communities particularly.
Millions in federal stimulus dollars will go directly to Alaskan communities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 27th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Republican leaders questioned the FBI about the handling of the Ted Stevens investigation.
And there's an issue here as to what happened there. And it may be a matter for oversight by this committee when the case is finished, or perhaps even sooner.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org.
The House today took the first step around the governor's decision not to accept part of the economic stimulus money the federal government has offered the state. The resolution that passed on a 32-3 vote simply certifies that the state will accept all the money available to it that is rejected by the governor. In explaining the resolution, which is an option under the federal appropriation, Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker recognized that the governor has accepted, as he said, a fair portion of the federal money, but not all.
A certain amount of that money that's not been accepted is certainly that is a fairly great controversy across the state. Support for education, support for unemployment, support for energy projects statewide. This resolution is necessary to preserve our option to continue to evaluate those program funds that have not been accepted and make a determination if we wish to pursue them further on down the line during this legislative session.
He said the resolution does not bind them to anything if details show its use would not be in the state's best interest. However, without it, the state would not have the authority to continue looking at the funds. Democrat Les Guerra supported the measure. He said the requirements of the federal law are complex and the time is getting closer to make final decisions on the money.
I think the legislature is doing a good job right now evaluating which funds make sense for the state and which ones don't. But, we should have been, I think, another month ahead of this with a fair evaluation of what these federal funds brought to the state. And I think it's disappointing that that we're probably a month behind the curve.
The resolution next goes to the Senate, where a similar resolution is already available for floor action as early as Monday. As the governor and legislators wrangle over what to do with some of the federal stimulus dollars, other pots of stimulus money are headed directly to communities here. More than two dozen community health centers throughout Alaska are slated to receive a total of $3.6 million. Senator Lisa Murkowski announced the breakdown of funds today. The money is coming from the Department of Health and Human Services. Murkowski says the funds will go to 26 centers and help expand services, add providers, and more.
Allow for greater access within the communities, building some additional facilities, and then with these funds that will be made available, just the opportunities to better meet the not only the health care needs, but kind of the expanded health needs, whether it's behavioral health, but really being able to meet the needs in our rural communities particularly.
Murkowski says the funds are significant since Alaskans face huge challenges getting access to local health care. Alaska's senior senator did not vote in favor of President Obama's stimulus package, but supports elements of it. The Obama administration estimates that the money headed to Alaska's health centers will create or keep 87 jobs and provide care for more than 16,000 new patients and nearly 7,500 new uninsured patients. Upwards of $100,000 is going to the Bethel Family Clinic, the Aleutian-Pribilof Islands Association, and Galena. The Bristol Bay Borough in Naknek and Kotzebue's Manilik Association will also receive nearly $120,000. The Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center will receive the biggest chunk at $242,000. Senator Mark Begich's office also announced this week Alaska's in line to receive $26 million in energy efficiency block grants if communities apply for it. The Department of Energy money includes $12 million that could go to 200 tribes in the state. Millions more are slated for Alaska's cities and boroughs, but the dollar amounts are available money. Senator Begich's spokeswoman Julie Haskett says communities must go to the Energy Department website and apply to take it.
they should just go onto the website and get the information to submit their application. The money is there. There is an allocation for Alaska. It's a significant allocation. So it's great if they could just get online and get through that application process, because we want to make sure that folks get the money that's due them and is sitting and waiting for them to get.
Communities and tribes do not need a green light from the governor or the state to apply for or take this money. It will go directly to the applicants. Anchorage could receive more than $2.5 million, the Mat-Su Borough $250,000, and the Kenai Peninsula more than $190,000. The Fairbanks Borough and City could get up to $410,000, and $50,000 is available for Haines, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, the Kodiak Island Borough, the North Slope Borough, and the Denali Borough, among others. Haskett says once cities, boroughs, and tribes apply, the money can be dispersed.
What we're seeing now is stimulus money is actually starting to come out, being released by the departments, and this whole goal of creating jobs, stimulating the economy, and putting real money in the pockets of Alaskans is happening. And particularly with energy, when folks are paying such high energy costs, this is going to be an opportunity for some of this grant money to be used for retrofits and other energy projects that hopefully are going to end up in reducing energy bills.
Eligible projects include retrofits to buildings and lightning, renewable energy projects, and creation of revolving efficiency funds. Included in the Department of Energy block grants is about $9.5 million that would go to the state itself. Governor Palin has not accepted that money, but the legislature may try to. Municipalities and nonprofit organizations around the state have, as of today, a single source of information on funding available under the federal economic stimulus plan. The Alaskan Clearinghouse is a partnership between the legislature and the Denali Commission. Staff is available for the next 6 months from sponsoring agencies. In announcing the service, House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker pointed out that the federal plan is complex, and the goal is to direct non-state groups to available funds through one central facility. The office will not make application or help with the grants themselves. It will only direct those interested to a possible funding source. Municipal League Executive Director Kathy Wasserman is also a member of the Denali Commission. She said her office is getting up to 30 telephone calls a day for tips on funding possibilities. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Lower Kuskokwim River residents get the first moose hunt in 5 years.
We want to harvest 70 or 60, 70, 80 moose, but we don't want to over-harvest.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at ArcticWireRope.com. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
SeaTac Airport in Seattle is handling about three times as many cargo planes as usual to accommodate flights unable to land at Anchorage because of ash from Mount Redoubt. The volcano erupted three times since last night, once at 11:45 p.m. Thursday evening and again at 12:30 and 8:40 this morning. The most recent eruption sent an ash plume 50,000 feet into the air. Alaska Airlines has resumed some flights in and out of Alaska following the mid-morning's massive eruption. Chris Way Thomas is a geologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. Today, he said the ash plume trailed to the north.
Yesterday, we were able to do a brief overflight of the volcano in the Drift River Valley. What we observed, there was some flooding in the lower Drift River, but not nearly as extensive as that occurred on the 22nd of March. We did see indications yesterday of dome growth. There was a telltale seismicity late yesterday afternoon. But it's possible that we're going to get into this dome building cycle where these lava domes are extruded in the vent, and they will grow to a certain size and then become unstable and collapse. This happened repeatedly during the 1989-90 eruption. The subsequent collapses and flows will melt snow and ice that's on the Drift Glacier.
He said there was no way of telling how long the dome build collapse cycle would last. The collapse sends hot rocks and magma reaching the surface, melting glacial snow and ice, and leading to downhill flooding. Wei Thomas says parts of the Drift Glacier are entirely gone at this point. That downstream flooding has increased concerns about the fate of Cook Inlet Pipeline Company's oil storage tanks at the Drift River facility. The tanks are protected by a dike, which has diverted mud flow away from them. Commander Joseph Loschuto, federal on-scene coordinator, says the dike is holding up well.
Cook Inlet Pipeline was able to fly out the person that built the original dike, and they did an assessment of the dike, and they found that it is holding as planned and is in very good condition. No damage was noted to it. Right now, I just want to let everyone know that the oil is in a perfectly safe location where it's at right now. We are looking at any possible risks with moving it to a different location or moving it out to a ship when time comes for a ship. We need to be able to ensure that from wherever the oil goes, from the tank to a tank ship or someplace else, that it's going to be a perfectly safe operation. The tanks that the oil is in are the best protected location within the tank farm at this point.
Loschuto says soundings have been taken around the Christie Lee platform, an offshore oil drilling loading platform that serves the Drift River facility. He says recent soundings indicate that there is nothing in the water that could pose a potential risk to a vessel that would be brought in to unload tanks. He did not specify when a ship could be brought into the loading dock. Loschuto says only two of the seven tanks at the facility contain oil, and they are the farthest from the mud flows. There's about 73,000 barrels of oil in each tank, he says, enough to keep the tanks from floating away if flooding gets past the dikes. Chevron spokeswoman Roxanne Sins today said that the 10 production platforms operated by Chevron and Cook Inlet have been hauling crude to Trading Bay and Granite Point for storage because the Drift River facility is not taking crude now. She says an additional storage tank was opened at one of the facilities that will ensure production can continue for at least an additional 7 days. The top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee in Congress says the panel should look into allegations of prosecutorial misconduct during the Ted Stevens trial. Pennsylvanian Senator Arlen Specter made his comments earlier this week during a hearing with FBI Director Robert Mueller.
And there's an issue here as to what happened there. And it may be a matter for oversight by this committee when the case is finished, or perhaps even sooner.
Specter is the committee's ranking Republican, but he noted it would be up to a Democratic chairman, Vermont's Patrick Leahy, to decide whether to actually take up the Stevens investigation. Alaska's former Senator Ted Stevens was convicted in October of lying on financial disclosure forms to conceal gifts. Soon after the trial wrapped up, an Anchorage-based FBI agent alleged misconduct by a fellow agent and federal prosecutors. A government witness also came forward and said prosecutors misled him. Now the case is mired in motions and hearings dealing with the fallout from the allegations, and Stevens' sentencing date has been delayed. Specter told Director Mueller he wants to know what the FBI is doing on the Stevens case. He also asked what, in general, the FBI does at its highest levels to make sure agents don't overreach and act inappropriately because they want to bring down big targets.
I'm going to put this similar question to Attorney General Holder, and I understand he's making a personal review of the Stevens matter with regard to impropriety of the prosecutors.
Director Mueller said he couldn't comment much on the Stevens case because it's still working its way through the courts and a Justice Department investigation.
The issues that you raised are the subject of post-trial motions are being addressed not only by the judge in the post-trial briefings and hearings, but also by a team at the Justice Department that is looking at the allegations, whether they relate to the prosecutors or the FBI.
Mueller outlined for Senator Specter and other members of the Judiciary Committee the oversight that goes into high-profile cases like Stevens. He also went through the steps of supervising the conduct of FBI agents. There will be a limited moose hunt on the lower Kuskokwim River this fall, the first moose hunt that the area has seen in 5 years. The hunt was approved by the Alaska Board of Game in a recent Anchorage meeting. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
The hunt will include the area that has been in a moose hunting moratorium for the past 5 years, which is from the village of Kalskag downriver to Eek near the coast. It will include the main stem of the Kuskokwim and all the tributaries. The hunt is limited in several ways in order to keep the moose population growing and still giving hunters a chance to get meat. It will run from September 1st through September 10th, and it is a bulls-only hunt. And even though the hunt is a state hunt and will be open to all state hunters, it is crafted towards a local subsistence hunt. Unit 18 area biologist for the state, Philip Perry, says having it be a registration hunt will help with that.
And the registration hunt gives us a whole bunch of additional tools to be able to control harvest and to look at what the harvest was.
To register for the hunt, hunters will have to obtain the registration permit in person within the hunting area before the hunt begins.
So we have a measure of the number of people hunting, and we have a way to, after the season and at the end of the season, to go back to all those hunters and ask to see if they were successful or not, or if they hunted or not. So it gives us a better way to assess what the harvest was. It also allows us to put extra restrictions on hunting.
Many of these restrictions are still to be decided on, but some of the permit conditions being considered include having the hunt for boats only, restricting aircraft from the hunt, requiring moose antlers to be cut in half, requiring specific parts of the moose to be harvested, like the organs and stomach fat. They are also considering a 48-hour reporting period. Perry says this will help them keep track of the amount of moose that are being harvested. Fish and Game's targeted harvest is 75 bulls. If there are higher numbers than that harvested within the first few days of the hunt, Perry says they could close the hunt by emergency order, but they hope that that doesn't have to happen.
By crafting it the way we are, we're hoping that, you know, there's enough areas the hunters just can't get to and enough bulls in the first few days see what's going on that become sneaky enough to not get harvested. But that balance of, you know, we want to harvest 70 or 60, 70, 80 moose, but we don't want to over-harvest.
As for the estimated moose numbers on the lower Kuskokwim right now, they have a good count from last year that they can add on to.
You know, if we had 900 or 1,000 last year, we could very easily, adding what production was this last year, have 12 or 1,300 moose. And I think I'm probably being conservative and not going way out on a limb saying that, but I think we're doing very well.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Academic researchers and tribal leaders are gathering in Juneau this week for a Tlingit Clan Conference. Speakers will address the arts, language, repatriation, clan structure, archaeology, and other topics. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has this preview.
The event is called Sharing Our Knowledge, a conference of Tlingit tribes and clans. It's the fifth in a series of gatherings held around Southeast Alaska since the early 1990s. Steve Henriksen, one of the organizers, says it's part symposium and part celebration.
They've all been combined elements of a academic Western-style conference where you have a lineup of speakers that are giving presentations and workshops, and also have elements of Tlingit cultural activities and ceremonies together with it. And it gives a chance for scholars in the Western tradition to meet with scholars in the Tlingit tradition.
One session provides a look at herring stalks using traditional knowledge and archaeological research. Another examines the use of radiocarbon dating in the region. Henriksen says the academic component brings research about Southeast's first residents back home.
Before the Clan Conference, you know, the people would go off to conferences on the East Coast or even in Europe, and sometimes the people here never got to hear the findings of this research, and there's really some fascinating research that's going on continually up here on Southeast Alaskan Native cultures.
There's also a major focus on Tlingit language and art. Sessions include weaving, beading, teaching Tlingit, name-giving, and clan songs.
At this point, there's a lot of people that really don't know that much about the clan structure, and so some of the activities at the conference will surround trying to get the word out about how the clan structure exists and some of the protocols involved in it.
The event is being dedicated to the memory of Andy Hope, a writer, educator, and conference founder who died last year. He will be celebrated in a tribute dinner and during a number of presentations. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Racers return to the trails tonight in Fairbanks for the skiathlon competition at the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships. Skiathlons are half-classic, half-skate technique events in which racers changed skis and poles at the halfway point. The women ski 2 7.5-kilometer loops, while the men race 2 15K laps. Today's skiathlons will be followed on Sunday with the final events of the championships, the men's and women's marathons. Anchorage's James Southam, who won the 10K Classic race at Nationals earlier in the week, is looking forward to the longer races. Southam says the distance courses at Birch Hill are on par with the toughest in the world.
The ones for this weekend are their World Cup quality. In the U.S., we really don't get a race many courses that are World Cup quality outside of Soldier Hollow, and so coming up here, it's great. I mean, get some really big courses and put all the domestic skiers on some world-class hills and world-class climbs, and I wish we had places with big climbs like this more often.
Southam will have stiff competition in the distance events. The man who won both of the long races at U.S. Nationals in Fairbanks last year, Canadian Ivan Babikoff, is expected on the start line. Several racers, including Babikoff and U.S. star Keegan Randall of Anchorage, arrived at this year's championships late due to travel delays caused by the eruption of Mount Redoubt. Randall says she's happy to be in Fairbanks to race after missing last spring's championships due to a blood clot in her leg.
I think I was really lucky that I got the right treatment and was able to get back to training fairly soon. And it couldn't have happened at a better time of year, so I had a long time before the first race to rebuild and get back up. And, I had a lot of motivation because after, sitting down and not being able to ski, I really decided that, I was really fortunate to be able to do that. So kind of a new motivation and appreciation for skiing after that.
Randall is a sprint specialist who became the first U.S. woman to win a medal at the World Championships last month when she took silver in the sprint competition. Randall says she's looking forward to being able to race distances for a change now that the sprint season is over.
Not definitely my forte, but it'll be fun to jump in with the girls and race it out.
Randall is planning a summer of training at home in Alaska in preparation for next year's Olympics in Vancouver, where she says the hilly sprint course suits her well. The 2009 U.S. Alpine Championships are also trying to get underway at Alyeska Ski Resort in Girdwood. The race was supposed to start at 11 a.m. with the women's Super G, but fog canceled the race. The men's race was scheduled to begin at 2:30, but at airtime were still on hold until the fog lifts. 200 athletes and coaches from around the nation are gathered at Alyeska. Opening ceremonies are tonight at 7 at the Day Lodge. Depending on the weather, ski events are scheduled to take place through Tuesday. Counting deer droppings is a time-honored method used by biologists to figure out how many deer are in a certain place. But it's not a perfect science. One deer's droppings tend to look the same as another's, and they're tough to find in brushy rainforest. But as KRBD's Jay Marble reports, biologists are now using DNA testing to identify and count deer.
Figuring out how many deer are in one place actually matters. It helps game managers set bag limits. Many methods can be used to estimate deer numbers. Managers can ask hunters how many deer they've seen or how many they've shot. That certainly gives a perspective, but it can also be subjective. Roadside counts and aerial surveys are also tough because of the brush and rough terrain. Counting deer droppings or pellets, which has been done over the last 30 or so years, also has some problems. Those pellets can melt in the many rain showers or simply end up deposited in hard-to-see places. In the winter, they'll be under snow. But for the last couple of years, university staff, fish and game biologists, and Forest Service biologists have been collecting deer pellets from Prince of Wales Island and extracting DNA. Todd Brinkman is a PhD student at the University of Fairbanks. Here he is explaining the nitty-gritty of how pellets are collected and managed.
Okay, so we're down in the field during the spring, and we collect these pellets, and we preserve them in these test tubes that are filled with ethanol, or it's just an alcohol preservative. And we bring them back, and they're basically stored in a box in a cabinet. But once we get back here, we extract DNA off the pellets, and then we basically have this very small test tube with clear liquid in it, and we don't deal with the pellets again. So, yeah, the lab isn't filled with random fecal pellets everywhere. They're stored. After DNA is extracted, they're stored, and we really don't deal with them again.
Brinkman says each pellet is like a little library. Not only does it identify a particular deer, but also reveals the sex of the deer. Knowing the ratio of males to females is one of the most important pieces for game managers, especially because antlerless hunts can be a very controversial practice. But getting back to collecting the pellets off the ground, Brinkman says the same deer trails get searched about every 10 days. When a group of pellets is found, a few are collected and the rest are removed.
So when we walk that exact same trail 10 days later, we know that all the pellet groups that we're encountering were freshly deposited, and the deer has been there since the last time we were. So we're getting some spatial information on the deer since we're recording the location of the pellet group, and we're getting some information on when it was there.
Brinkman says for the first time in Southeast Alaska, biologists are actually getting detailed estimates of numbers. These pellets are collected in all kinds of terrains and elevations. It just so happens that the first 2 years of the study coincided with very harsh winters.
And our preliminary data right now is at least showing that those harsh winters did have a pretty significant impact on deer numbers in all the watersheds that we looked at.
Brinkman says having 3 years of very detailed genetic information from pellets might also give greater value to data collected from pellets over the last 20 or 30 years, even though those pellets were not tested for DNA. At this point, the data from the last 3 years is being processed. Besides being valuable for game managers, Brinkman says the data will be described in community reports, which may also include density maps of the various drainages where the pellets were collected. I'm Jay Marble.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Jay Marble on Prince of Wales Island. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan. Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spinard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.